cost of the ancient schools of philosophy when we're looking at the Stoic school. I may have some time to begin that discussion today, but I'll certainly get into it next week. We have readings from Stoic philosopher Epictetus in the course path, which I'll begin to this time next week. So last time we were talking about Epicurus, his idea of pleasure. Pleasure is the highest good, a view that's called hedonism. We saw a very important distinction. You'll just be totally lost in Epicurus if you don't understand this distinction between catastomatic pleasure and kinetic pleasure. It's specifically catastomatic pleasure that that Epicurus elevates to the place of the highest good. That catastomatic pleasure, he analyzes, there are two broad kinds or families of catastomatic pleasure. There are those that he calls aponia, the pleasures of leisure, of idleness, physical ease, stressless well-being, and the pleasures of what he calls ataraxia, the pleasure of an untroubled, tranquil mind. The important lesson that he wants to teach in life is to always pursue those catastomatic pleasures. Now that we understand his view about pleasure, we talked last time pleasure is not sensation. We distinguish pleasure as a feeling from the goodness of good sensations. We can ask, why did he say that it's the highest good? And he gives two arguments for these. Scholars put labels on these arguments, and that's what I'm indicating here, cradle argument and conceptual argument. Those are just labels that scholars have put on his different arguments for why hedonism, why pleasure is the highest good. This cradle argument, the idea is that it's the good that we all recognize from the moment we're born, in the cradle. Even babies acknowledge that it's good. Pleasure is the first good that any human being recognizes. It's what we naturally pursue unless we're motivated to change somehow. It's the original natural good, chosen by all of us just because we're human beings, without any further consideration. So that's one reason why pleasure should be given the elevated position that Epicurus does. The other is what's called the conceptual argument. If we try to conceive of something else as the highest good, say, okay, it's not pleasure, it's something else. Truth, virtue, wisdom, money, health, reputation. If you try to put anything else in the position of the highest good, then the Epicureans argue that the whole idea of good becomes unsupportable and implausible, unconvincing. Money, learning, virtue even, imagine all of those with no pleasure at all. Why call it good? Why dedicate your life to it? Why pursue it if it doesn't ultimately lead to pleasure rather than pain? The goodness of pleasure is not an inference. It's not a hypothesis. It's not a theory. The goodness of pleasure is directly given to us like the heat of the fire when you put your hand into it. We feel the heat directly, regardless of any kind of learning that we have, any kind of theories that we may hold, without any kind of argument. And so too, Epicurus says, for pleasure. We like it immediately. We like it before we even have a name for it. We like it before we even connect it with definite objects. And the Epicureans say that the more philosophy strays from this central position and value of pleasure, the more abstruse and unpersuasive its life teaching must become. Now Plato, by the time of Epicurus, Plato would have been either very old or would have died. He would have hated this teaching. He could have had the opportunity to experience it. He would have hated this teaching. He would have hated the materialism, the atomism. He would have hated the hedonism. He would have hated putting pleasure above wisdom, virtue, truth. Now Plato thought that he had a simple argument to show that this elevation of pleasure is an obvious mistake. He said that any pleasure is made better by adding a virtue to it. Pleasure plus wisdom is better than pleasure without wisdom. Pleasure plus truth is better than pleasure without truth. Pleasure plus virtue is better than pleasure without virtue. So Plato said, obviously, pleasure can't be the highest good. Now, to Epicurus, this is a completely fallacious argument. And its fallacy depends on exactly the point that I was talking about last time. Plato doesn't see that absolutely crucial distinction between kinetic pleasures and catastomatic pleasures. Plato is thinking, in that argument that I just rehearsed, he's thinking only of what Epicurus would call kinetic pleasures. From Epicurus's point of view, you can't add wisdom to pleasure. That's nonsense. Wisdom is already pleasure. It's pleasant to be wise. It's a catastomatic pleasure to be wise. Of course, you could add wisdom to kinetic pleasure, but the result would simply be the wise use of kinetic pleasure, and that itself is pleasant again. To have the wisdom to handle kinetic pleasures well is itself a catastomatic pleasure. Now, I mentioned that this philosophy of Epicurus is called hedonism, from the Greek word for pleasure. Hedonism is the idea that pleasure is the highest good, the sole intrinsic good. When critics these days, or back in antiquity, when anybody criticizes hedonism, as our moralists still do, when anybody criticizes hedonism, if you listen carefully to what they're saying, you will always find that their argument only applies to what the Epicureans would call kinetic pleasure. The arguments never apply to, or never even work, for catastomatic pleasures. The usual arguments against hedonism were the same back in antiquity as the ones you'll hear today. One argument that supposedly shows that hedonism is a big mistake is that the single-minded pursuit of those kinetic pleasures is not worth the inevitable pain and trouble. Kinetic pleasures depend on objects that have to be acquired, that cost money, and these kind of pleasures generate new difficulties of mental and physical dissipation. That's one argument you hear. A second argument you hear against hedonism is that the pursuit of those kinetic pleasures distracts people from more important values. It undermines the spirit with boredom and futility and despair. We become materialistic, addicted to the materials from which we get our kinetic fix. Now, the thing about those arguments, supposedly refutations of hedonism, is Epicurus would completely agree with both of those points. Absolutely. So long as you understand that what you're talking about there is kinetic pleasure, he says that's absolutely right. That's why it's so important to understand the difference between kinetic and catastomatic pleasure. A life devoted to kinetic pleasure is a blunder, because it's not all that pleasant. That kind of life is distracted from something of greater importance, and this would be Epicurus's own argument. All the philosophers agree, Plato and Aristotle as much as Epicurus, that there's something more important than mere kinetic pleasure. The originality of Epicurus is to say that this neglected, more important thing, it's not truth or virtue like Aristotle or the Stoics or Plato said. It's something that the earlier thinkers didn't clearly distinguish, these special catastomatic things. The danger of kinetic pleasure is that it can interfere with the pursuit of catastomatic pleasure, which is the really highest good. For Epicurus, we don't have to choose between a life of pleasure and a life of virtue. The important choice is between two different kinds of pleasure. There's a higher and a lower hedonism, a vulgar and an elite. Only the higher hedonism, a hedonism of catastomatic pleasure, refined and philosophical, only that kind of hedonism promotes lasting happiness. I want to turn to the top topic that's in the middle of my overhead here. This is all on the Avenue page. The topic of virtue. Justice is the only inherent good. Pleasure. The Epicurean teaching, pleasure is the only inherent good. It's the highest good. That doesn't mean it's the only good at all. Other things are good too. Money is good if it leads to pleasure. Of course, if it leads to pain, it's not good. So other goods are instrumental and good depending on how they connect with parastomatic pleasure. So every pleasure is good, but not all pleasures are choiceful. Every pain is bad, but not all pains are to be avoided. Catastomatic pleasure is the highest good. So if we take that picture all together, how should we organize our life? That's the problem of virtue for an Epicurean philosopher. Virtues will be those characteristic traits, courage, justice, friendship, and so on, with those characteristic traits that collaborate and contribute to building a life in which catastomatic pleasure can be maximized. So these virtues will be other qualities that we need in order to lead the kind of life that the Epicureans favor. And the very first among these virtues will be the virtue of prudence, practical wisdom. A truly prudent person has an infallible knowledge of the consequences of kinetic pleasure. And with this knowledge, he or she can regulate whether to choose or avoid various kinetic pleasures, so that those pursuits of those pleasures never interferes with the ongoing, continuous enjoyment of catastomatic pleasure. So what kind of life would be the most prudent, supposing that we accept the Epicurean teaching and want to maximize our catastomatic pleasure? First thing we should do to be prudent is to aim for self-sufficiency. That will be a second virtue on this account. Aim for self-sufficiency. A simple life maximizes catastomatic pleasure. We're advised to cultivate leisure, to avoid politics, to prefer a private life, to keep a private garden, keep a low profile, live unknown. To become someone that's been heard of is a source of trouble. A really successful life is a cunningly unsuccessful life. We're advised by the Epicureans to curb our ambition to have more than we need. Terrible mistake to always be burning to have more than we need. If we can learn to live on a little, even if we're rich, even if we're the wealthiest man in Athens, but if despite our wealth, we can still live happily with pleasure on a little, then if something happens, you know, because life is not predictable, if something happens and suddenly we lose all that wealth, well, we don't need it. It doesn't make us unhappy. Our catastomatic pleasure can just continue as it had because we're accustomed to living carefully. So that means that prudence and self-sufficiency require the further virtue of frugality. Frugality means being satisfied with having all that you need, understanding that it's enough. And that's the hard bit, understanding that you've got enough. The more frugal you are, the less you have to toil. The less you toil, the more opportunity you have to enjoy catastomatic pleasure. Now, wealth is an ambiguous value. That wealth is of some good, seems obvious. And yet, to suppose that wealth is the most important good is a sadly common mistake and the waste of wealth. Epicurus does not advocate poverty. Frugality, yes. Poverty, no. What he wants is for us to think about wealth in a new way. What unphilosophical people call wealth is either just money, which is not wealth, but the means to enjoy wealth, or it is some fashionable but groundless opinion. Philosophical wealth is an abundance of catastomatic pleasure, and a life arranged to ensure. If you have that, the abundance of charismatic pleasure and a life that's arranged to allow you to continuously enjoy that, if you have that, then you're rich, regardless of how much money you have. This philosophical will is not conventional. It doesn't depend on other people's opinion. It has a basis in nature, in human nature, in our natural needs and spontaneous values, and it's easy to acquire and maintain. Friendship is another virtue. Being a friend, having friends, those are the best way to support a life dedicated to catastomatic pleasure. The specific value of friendship lies in the awareness among a circle of friends that they're not alone, that there are others who will come to their assistance in a time of need. That sense of security is the catastomatic pleasure that comes from the virtue of friendship. Cultivating friendships, of being a friend, and having friends. So there are some of the Epicurean virtues. The most important one, your prudence, your practical wisdom, your self-sufficiency, your frugality, your friends, and your friendliness, and your capacity for friendship. A last virtue that I'm going to speak about for the Epicureans is justice. We can't be happy if we're unjust. But Epicurus has a somewhat complicated idea about exactly what justice is and why it's good. He invents what will, in later times, go on to become the leading idea of modern social and political philosophy.
Look,
the idea of a social contract. On Epicurus' account, human life begins without any kind of social organization. He tries to imagine way, way back in the past, farther than anybody can remember, before the Homeric tales, before the Trojan War, before all of history that anyone can recall, at the very primitive state of human life. In that condition, he says, we didn't have any social organization. These oldest ancestors of ours, they lived a solitary life without agriculture, without fire, without clothes, even without language. The first phase of civilization comes when these extremely primitive human beings make an agreement among themselves to prevent harming each other. Now, this agreement is extremely rudimentary because these people, the proto-people, they don't even yet have a language. So Epicurus is pretty sketchy about how exactly they come to this agreement. But supposedly they come to an agreement to not harm each other. Let's be friends. You like it, I like it, you have peace, I have peace. That's the motive that they get together. It's not fear that drives them into this primitive agreement. What drives them into this primitive agreement is the desire to enjoy the pleasure of friendship. You see, it's unpleasant to be constantly prepared to harm others. It's not just the danger of you being harmed, but you've got to be always on the spot. Every time you walk out of your cave, you've got to be looking around, carrying a big stick, ready to smash the other guy before he smashes you. That's not pleasant. Nobody enjoys being on all the time like that. Friendship is a much more enjoyable state for everyone. And so for Epicurus, it's friendship, not fear, and pleasure, not justice, that lies at the origin of social organization. Now, under this new arrangement, where people just make this kind of primitive pact of non-aggression, under that primitive arrangement, life flourished. People invented language, they invented property, they invented money, they began to engage in exchange, civilization flourishes. But, of course, all those things, property, money, civilization, all of those things produced, as they must, inevitably, more complications, more troubles, more conflict. And so it was at this point that the ancestors perceived the need for a new and more formal kind of contract that would lay out the terms of social life and their sanctions. And this is the origin of law, the beginning of justice in an explicit social contract. Now, on this Epicurean social contract account, justice is not natural, but it's not entirely conventional either. It originates in a convention, but the motive for the convention is natural. The motive is in our nature, the natural pleasure of security and friendship. This social justice theory of this social contract theory of justice, it is stridently anti-Platonic. Another respect in which Plato would have been infuriated by the Epicurean philosophy. It's anti-Platonic because for these Epicureans, justice has no meaning apart from conventions. Arbitrary stipulations that a community makes for itself. There's no justice in itself, independent of human decisions about how to regulate our relations. Justice is not a pure idea, like Plato loved and believed in. There is no idea of justice. It's a human contrivance. It's designed to promote pleasure. That's one reason Plato would have hated this idea. But another reason, too, is that for the Epicureans, justice isn't eternal. It changes all the time. The demands of justice change when the circumstances change. Everything right or wrong depends on the particular circumstances of the community. Again, on this account, justice is not inherently good. It's not absolutely good. It's it's not absolutely good, but also evil. Injustice. Injustice isn't automatically a bad thing. Justice is not necessarily good. Injustice isn't automatically a bad thing. A life of injustice is, though, risky, and therefore imprudent, and consequently unwise. A life of injustice has to sorely interfere with a person's tranquility. The unjust can never be sure that their crimes will catch up with them. Years later, decades later, right up to his death, Epicurus said. It is unclear whether he will actually escape. Now, you can't enjoy catastomatic pleasure with that kind of anxiety hanging over your life. And that's why Epicurus says it is imprudent and therefore unwise to be unjust. Well, Epicurus is offering us a really profound alternative to the idealism or spiritualistic philosophy that we saw in Plato, in Aristotle. And this Epicurean philosophy has proved to be offensive to the religious of any age, right down to our time. Because now, at the end, let's just step back and just ask yourself, what really is Epicurus teaching? He's saying that our world is not unique. It's just one of infinitely many worlds in an endless void. He's saying that there's nothing spiritual in nature. And human beings are not special in nature. Human beings are just animals, machines, systems of matter, like everything else. He's saying that God or the gods take no interest in human affairs, and cannot be moved to our assistance by prayers or sacrifices. And lastly, he's saying that religious ceremonies are just empty superstitions. But what's worse, they are ways that the powerful few dominate the less powerful men. The aim of Epicurean philosophy is to liberate everybody from that kind of domination. And the domination of superstition, superstitious people. The Epicureans formulated what they called their tetrapharmakos. That's a complicated Greek word. It just means fourfold remedy. Tetra, four, pharmakos, remedy, like pharmacy. Because back then, you know, Epicurus, if you can believe it, we had no internet. No iPad. And so, of course, teachings were much more fragile. There was nothing to hold a teaching except what you remember. You might come to Athens and sit at Epicurus' feet for a good couple of years and really feel that that was, you know, an incredibly important part of your life. And something happened to you back then that you never want to forget. And so you needed to have something, maybe a letter, a scroll, something you could take with you because you had to leave Athens and go back home somewhere far, far away in the Alexandrian Empire. And so they had to think of ways to reduce the teaching to something people could hold on to. That's why those two pieces of writing we have from Epicurus are relatively short. They're not those long, drawn-out dialogues like Plato or treatises like Aristotle, but short summaries of the teaching. This tetrapharmakos is even more. It's a slogan that anybody can remember. Once you hear it, you can remember it. The elegant summary of their philosophy. Gods present no fears. Death presents no worries. What is good is readily attainable, and what is terrible is readily endurable. All you have to do in life to live wisely, philosophically, is to submit everything to prudent calculation, never rest in opinion, understand the value of pleasure, act justly, maintain peaceable relations with others, especially with friends. If you can practice those simple precepts by day and night, by yourself and with your friends, then you'll never be disturbed. But Epicurus says you can live like a god among men. Okay, I have a good piece of time, and I want to make a start on the next group of philosophers that we're going to talk about so I can get into it in more detail next week. And that's the Stoics. But I'm also going to talk about another school that the Stoics are closely connected with called the Cynics. That's a surprising name. We'll talk about that. But this Stoic school was founded by a man named Zeno of Citium. Zeno is an extremely common name in antiquity, so you need to know which Zeno we're talking about. And specifying him, he's known as Zeno of Citium. He was not born in Athens, he was born in the city of Citium, but he came to Athens about 300 BCE, and he began teaching. And he taught in a public place, like all, you know, all these philosophers have their school, but it's just that the Stoics, Zeno, he began teaching right in the Agora, in downtown Athens. If you've ever been to Athens, the archaeologists have discovered this. You can see this place right down at the foot with the that famous mount. His name is escaping up above them. And in the Agora, the open place, the marketplace, it had one covered walkway that was supported by pillars and then covered, you know, because the Athens sun is very hot. So it was nice to have shade. In Greek, the name for a painted colonnade, that's a painted row of covered area standing up on pillars, is called a stoa. And that's where Zeno hung out. That's where Zeno did his teaching. And so his teaching became known as the Stoic teaching, the teaching at the stoa. He was teaching in Athens about almost exactly the same time as Epicurus. It's now been just a couple of generations after the death of Socrates. Now, before I talk about these Stoics, I want to interpolate a discussion of a related school called the Cynics. Now, this name, Cynic, this comes from the Greek word for dog. Now, there are lots of stories about why exactly was this group of philosophers called Cynics. There's no one definitive reason why they're called Cynics. But one of the stories is that people gave them that name, that is, they called it, you dog, because the Cynics just loved to shock people. with their uncivilized behavior. They were absolutely notorious for this throughout antiquity. They were notorious for masturbating or for having sex in public, just like a dog would. Now, if the name was thrown at them, you cynic, you dog, if that name was intended as an insult, the cynics just turned it right around and made it into a term of praise. They say, okay, you call me a dog, I'll call my philosophy the dog philosophy. Because dogs have it right. The thing about dogs is they are so indifferent to people's conventions. You know, you're trying to take your dog for a walk and it meets another dog and it does something that nobody would ever do. The cynics say, if we were more like that, we'd be happy. The greatest of these cynics is a man named Diogenes. Diogenes of Sinope. Diogenes is another extremely common name in antiquity, so to keep him straight, he said this is Diogenes from Sinope. Sinope was a city in what would, in the Greek world now, but in the contemporary world, it would be in Turkey, on the Black Sea in northwestern or northeastern Turkey. But he came to Athens shortly after Socrates died. Plato was still alive. Plato was still teaching when Diogenes showed up. And it was Plato who left us the description of Diogenes as Socrates gone mad. Now, there are pages and pages in the ancient sources of stories about Diogenes. He expressed his philosophy through a kind of performance art. Supposedly, he wrote books. We have none of these left. But we were told that he wrote books. But the other way that he taught was not through writing books, but by a kind of a performance art. Everybody in Athens knew Diogenes. And every time you saw him, you could expect some fun. In fact, all of you already know, probably, a story about Diogenes. You just didn't know that it was Diogenes, that he was a cynic. You didn't know all the context. But you've all heard that story, I think, about the man who went walking in the marketplace in broad daylight, noon, with a lit lantern, walking with his lantern. People would say, what are you doing? I'm looking for an honest person. That was Diogenes. Supposedly, he lived in an old wine cask. He didn't have a house. He just got an old wine cask people didn't want. At night or when it rained, he just crawled in there. The Emperor Alexander even heard of Diogenes. He was so famous. The Emperor Alexander sought Diogenes out, came to him, found him. Of course, he's emperor of the world, the most powerful man in the world. So he says to Diogenes, what can I give you? What would you like? Diogenes said, I'd like you to move just that far. You're standing in my sunshine. Sometimes Diogenes would, when there was a theater performance, he would wait outside the theater until the performance was over. All the crowd now surging out of the theater, trying to get out. At that moment, not a moment before, but only when they're all, you know, crowding to get out, get the fresh air, use the toilet. At that moment, he tries to get in. So, you know, he's pushing through. People say, why are you doing that? He says, that's what I own. That's my whole life. Cynic teaching. Move like a dog. The dogs know something. There's a dog wisdom. Why can't we find it? Why can't we do that happen? One of the main teachings, then, is the superiority of nature over culture. The things that are conventional. The cynic sees through false needs and disburdens himself of commitment. Cheerfully embraces poverty, like Diogenes living in that old wine cask. People, once again, another thing, people would find Diogenes, what he'd do is, you know, the Greeks, they had all those Greek statues. So Athens, you know, there'd be statues all over various places, famous men, famous generals, and so on. What Diogenes liked to do is, he'd go up to the statues and try to beg. You know, go up to the statue, spare change, man. To all the statues. But people say, why? What are you doing? and said, I gotta get practice in being refused. A cynic shakes off any commitment to politics, family, duties, obligations. Cynics won't show up on time. They can't be expected to have the rent check on the first of the month. Diogenes himself said, I am a man with no city, no fatherland, no home. He said, I am a citizen of the universe. Universe in Greek, cosmos. Citizen, related to the word polos, the city. Diogenes said, I am a cosmopolite. He coined that word that we still have. I am a cosmopolite. My home is the universe. Nothing more special. The cynics reverse the usual conception of the relation of the animal to the human being. To be godlike, they teach, to be godlike, emulate the animals, follow the dogs, live according to nature. Now, the cynics also have a very specific and strongly held ethical orientation. This is what makes these cynics not just philosophers, but really Socratics. Maybe it's a kind of insane Socratism, as Plato said. Maybe it seems insane to a different kind of Socratic like Plato. But they did think of themselves as a kind of Socratic. They insist, as Socrates did, that happiness and living well is the true test of philosophy. The cynics take that further than Socrates might have intended. They eliminate all theory. Philosophy for them is the art of living. Diogenes once explained, somebody asked him, what's philosophy? Why is it good? He said, philosophy, to be a philosopher, is to be prepared for any kind of luck. Imagine if you could be prepared for any kind of luck. That means whatever happens, it doesn't disturb your kind of luck. It doesn't destroy your soul. You are imperturbable. Luck, fate, destiny, accident, it can't touch you. Now, I don't know about you, but to the Greeks, he said, that is godlike. If we could have that, that would be happy. A third component of the cynic teaching is discipline. They may not have engaged in highfalutin theory, but they definitely demanded from their students or pupils, disciples, a strong discipline. The cynics dispense with that passage through theory that Epicurus and Plato and Aristotle all indulged in. But they insist on a very arduous training and discipline, what in Greek is called aesthesis, from which we get our word ascetic. The cynics believe that happiness ought to be possible even under the most adverse conditions. But to get to that point where you can be prepared for any kind of luck, where you can be happy under even the most adverse conditions, to get to that point, you have to train yourself. Cynics prepare for adversity by living a little uncomfortably every day. They compare themselves to athletes. They say, the athletes, they train for victory in the stadium. We cynic philosophers train to strengthen our will and capacity for endurance. Now, Zeno, whom I mentioned at the beginning when I started talking about Stoicism, Zeno, the founder of the Stoic school, when he first came to Athens, there was no Stoic school, of course, he invented it. When he first came to Athens and decided to be a philosopher, he apprenticed himself to one of the cynics, not Diogenes, but another cynic called Crates, who is perhaps most famous for the woman that he married. Also a cynic philosopher, Hipparchia, the most famous female philosopher of the ancient world. Female philosophers back then were very rare. So Zeno began his career in philosophy with the cynics, but he was unsatisfied with their approach, and he sought to reintroduce some of the things that they threw out, especially theory. theory of nature, the importance of knowledge. Cynics, as I was saying, tend to be quite hostile to theory. It seemed useless, or worse, it seemed to them to be not the right kind of thing at all to focus on if what you're trying to do is be the best that a human being can be. So to understand this relation between the Cynics and the Stoics, let's take a step back and think about how both of these schools relate to Socrates. For Socrates, you know, philosophy was a way of taking care of yourself. People ought to work more on their virtue. They ought to do more to make themselves as good as a human being can be. And philosophy, after the model of Socrates, will aspire to be an art or a method of doing that. That's one idea in Socrates. But there was another idea in Socrates, one that he drew into philosophy from the Pythagoreans and from Parmenides, that said that the way to take care of yourself, the way to take care of your soul, is to pursue knowledge of truth. Plato and Aristotle, after Socrates, they made a lot of that. They elevated that pursuit of knowledge of truth to the summit of the philosophical life. Aristotle said that was happiness, contemplating truth. Now, why is truth supposed to be so important for Plato, for Aristotle? Because that's where the soul is most at home. The soul is happy when it's with what it recognizes as its own. The essence of the soul and the principle of truth in reality are the same. And in thinking the truth, we're doing the best thing that a human being can do. So what happens in Plato, what happens in Aristotle, the way they transform the inheritance of their teacher Socrates, is that they think the way to take care of yourself is through self-knowledge, through delving into the soul, through going into its interior and recognizing inside the soul its kinship with the divine. To properly care for yourself, you need knowledge, but not knowledge of the outside world, not knowledge of nature, of the cosmos. You require especially knowledge of the soul, of its interior essence, and of its kinship with the divine. Now, you can see the Cynics as an attempt to rescue Socratic philosophy from this preoccupation with truth and science that Plato and Aristotle gave. If philosophy is to be what Socrates proposed, the art of taking care of yourself, then the Cynics think it has to abandon a Platonic commitment to knowledge of truth. For Cynics, the most important knowledge isn't about truth at all. It's knowing how to live. And for that, theory and reasoning are useless. It's an ethical kind of art, an art of living that can only be taught by example through the Stoic way of life, as exemplified in those notorious antics of the great Cynics, starting with Diogenes. But when he did those things, living in his caste, walking with a lantern in daylight, begging from statues, that was how he taught. They weren't just jokes. And he thought they were better than written treatises. And think about that. Here we are, 21st century. Almost 2,500 years after Diogenes, and his teaching is just as vivid as now. That story about looking for an honest man, begging from statues, you'll remember that the rest of your life. Way better than any book. That's how he taught. Now the Stoics say there ought to be a middle ground. I mean, we've got Plato with his inner eye on the pure idea, and we've got Diogenes walking around telling jokes. Two polemically different ideas of what philosophy is or how you care for yourself, care for your soul. The Cynics say, isn't there some middle ground here? Doesn't knowledge, even theory, science, doesn't it have some something to contribute to taking care of yourself? The cynics, Zeno came to think, they threw out too much. There is a useful kind of knowledge of nature and of natural causes that is indispensable to happiness and virtue. It won't be the metaphysics of Plato and Aristotle. Instead, it will be something closer to the physical theories of those pre-Socratic Ionians like Anaximander and Xenophanes and Heraclitus. And the Stoics say it's necessary that philosophy develop this branch of useful theoretical knowledge. Now, that was exactly the argument of Epicurus, too. He says, in one of our readings, he says, the purpose of studying nature is to gain a sharp understanding of the causes of those things that are most important. The theory of nature in Epicurus, it's very different from the Stoics. I'll be getting into that next week. It's a different theory of nature, but the reason that the Stoics develop a theory of nature at all, and the reason that the Epicureans develop their theory of nature at all, it's the same. It's to keep the central value of knowledge and science or philosophy. Okay, that's a nice introduction to the Stoic teaching. There's a lot more material that we need to get into, and if you've got a reading from Epictetus, that'll be what we'll get to next week.